This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of October 31st, 2021. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 210, and happy Halloween. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. The Is It Just Me commentary. And the big deal feature. The Beijing Olympics are now less than 100 days away. Should the world boycott Xi Jinping's Winter Games over China's treatment of Uyghurs, Tibetans, and Hong Kongers, and Xi's threats to annex Taiwan? I welcome China expert Charles Burton from the McDonnell Laurier Institute to talk about these issues. But first, is it just me? Is it just me, or has the new Democratic Party stopped listening to its elders? Last week on this podcast, former Attorney General Colin Gableman was a guest. He is the father of BC's 1993 Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Law. He gave the October 18th tabled amendments a thumbs down and urged the Horgan NDP government to refer Bill 22 to the all-party committee that reviews the law every 5 years. That committee has yet to meet. The BC Liberals proposed just that, but the NDP used its majority to vote it down. So that committee is now useless. Among the NDP MLAs were Attorney General David Eby and Health Minister Adrian Dix. When they were in opposition, they both brought important information about BC Liberal corruption to daylight by using Freedom of Information. No NDP members spoke in favor of Bill 22 on October 26th when the amendment was up for debate in the legislature. This is BC Liberal critic Mike DeYoung, a former minister in charge of the government's FOI department.
I guess it's easy to stand here and make fun of the situation. But there's really an important principle at stake here. And it gets back to that second prediction I made. That turning point in the life of a government, armed as this one is, with a healthy majority in this place, that is now saying to British Columbians, we actually don't have to explain anything. We don't have to explain anything. We can do it because we want to, and we have a majority.
This is NDP Citizen Services Minister Lisa Baer.
It is very interesting because there seems to be a whole lot of misinformation being spread by the members opposite about what this bill is. And I know it makes me sad, members opposite, that the members opposite feel it necessary to invoke fear in the public rather than actually have a conversation about what this bill is and how it's going to continue to improve the lives of British Columbians by allowing them to continue accessing the services that they need, by continuing to strengthen their privacy protections, and to continue to give them access to their personal information in a timely manner.
The NDP later began the clause-by-clause third reading debate. The BC Freedom of Information and Privacy Association and the Canadian Association of Journalists both added their voices to Information and Privacy Commissioner Michael McAvoy, who earlier issued a 7-page rebuke of the government's bill. In CAJ President Brent Jolly's letter, he said, quote, Bill 22 takes the free out of freedom of information. In one fell swoop, we have gone from the 21st century back to the Stone Age with this bill. It is a thumb in the eye of transparency. End quote. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast.
No human rights, no games.
No human rights, no games.
Boycott Beijing.
Boycott Beijing.
Boycott Beijing.
Those are sounds of an October 27th protest outside the Vancouver Convention Center beside the Vancouver 2010 Olympic cauldron by groups protesting China's human rights record. This week's guest on the Big Deal feature is Charles Burton, senior fellow with the McDonnell Laurier Institute and a former Canadian diplomat and intelligence advisor. The Olympic flame is in China. The 100-day countdown to the 2022 Winter Games in Beijing came and went last week, but it was an athlete from a summer sport who made more noise. Boston Celtic Enes Kanter called Xi Jinping a dictator and wore decorated shoes to protest human rights abuses against Tibetans and Uyghurs.
The Uyghur region has become an open-air prison and surveillance state where freedoms are non-existent for the Uyghur people. The Chinese government has sent Uyghurs, along with Kazakhs, Tajiks, and other Muslim groups to concentration camps for simply applying for a passport, for texting someone overseas, or for believing in anything that does not align with the Chinese Communist Party's agenda.
That was Enes Kanter of the Boston Celtics on Twitter.
Charles, first of all, wanted to get your thoughts on Kanter's stance and why you think winter athletes and sponsors of the Winter Games are so reluctant to put a foot forward.
You know, an athlete as a prominent figure does have a platform to express political views. And, you know, you've got a lot of celebrities who take political causes on themselves and try and support causes that they believe in because they can add a certain prestige and charisma to those causes. And so I think it's, you know, not unreasonable that we would see athletes trying to mobilize support for genocide and crimes against humanity and human rights abuses that are going on with the regime in Beijing. So, you know, I think that it's a legitimate thing for an athlete to do as an individual. Of course, he's not representing any athletic federation or his basketball team or the NBA or anything. The NBA got into trouble previously with this kind of statement resulting in them being banned from the Chinese market, an enormous financial loss to the NBA for not being able to generate income from advertising from Chinese basketball fans. So, you know, it is a provocative stand because his, you know, his team would and owners would not be happy to see him eliciting a retaliatory response from China. I think in terms of the other issue, you know, the Olympics are set for Beijing in 100 days. Obviously, the athletes who have been preparing for those Olympics for many years, an opportunity to compete and demonstrate their excellence in their chosen sport, want to compete, you know, and they're not necessarily people who have any particular political consciousness. So one can understand how they are trying to finesse this issue and suggesting that it's an international event and that athletes, if they felt so inclined, could express their views on Chinese politics. That was certainly a statement that was made last week by a senior member of the Canadian Olympic Committee. I think that there are a couple of things here that are of concern. One is that if any athletes did make any kind of political statement in the current climate in China, it could become very serious for them. You know, they might feel that it's important for them to indicate to the people back home that while they're competing in the Olympics, they don't agree with the policies of the Chinese Communist Party. But the chance of retaliation under current conditions in China for that sort of political activity is fairly substantial. You know, and of course, the detainment of Michael Kovrig and Michael's favor sets a distressing precedent for the Chinese government's desire to achieve their purposes in the West. And that would include suppressing any discourse that suggests that there's genocide going on or that China has violated its commitment to the people of Hong Kong or, you know, any of the other many issues of concern that we have with regard to China's domestic and international behavior. You know, the other aspect of it is that, you know, a while back when we became aware that there's clearly much more serious concerns about Chinese regime behavior than we had previously earlier identified, but specifically the genocide. You know, there was a movement to try and get the Olympics out of Beijing and say, postpone the games, or to hold an Olympics that would be across several countries. You know, you could have Vancouver and Seattle, for example, that have existing facilities hosting the events, which would have allowed the athletes an opportunity to compete, but would have taken away the negative aspects of having to compete inside the People's Republic of China. Unfortunately, no government seems to have had the political courage to pursue that. And of course, the Olympic Committee, which you know, depends significantly on financial benefits from hosting the games in China, opposed it virulently. But in any event, that didn't happen. So now we're 100 days away. And you know, the Olympics could be disrupted if, in fact, there are boycotts, which, you know, could happen by, say, the United States or Australia or other countries that have a more principled approach to China. And, you know, what's the point of Olympics if some of the best athletes in the world are not there? I think from Canada's point of view, you know, right now we've got our flags here in Canada all over the country at half mast because of our concerns over the unmarked graves of Indigenous children who attended the former residential schools. So do we really want our flag flying at full mast next to the flag of the People's Republic of China and providing a legitimacy to a regime that we feel is engaged in activities which are completely unacceptable in terms of the norms and values of the rules-based international order? So, you know, politically, it seems if we do participate in the Olympics that Canada cannot but be drawn into an exercise to celebrate China, as was the case in the 2008 Olympics, and sending out a signal to the Chinese people that the international community affirms what that regime is doing. So, you know, there's a lot of troubling stuff here, and I am worried about how it's going to pan out in 100 days.
I covered the 2008 Beijing Olympics. China delivered a domestic message and an international message. The message to the world was that China was opening up. Western leaders had the naive belief that China was on the road to democracy. Under Xi Jinping, it's a great leap backward.
Can this be a turning point for the world to stop China in any way by having a boycott? If not a boycott of athletes and teams, then what about a boycott of diplomats? What can be done? Because this could be, as many have compared it to, Xi Jinping's version of what you know, Hitler did from a propaganda standpoint with the 1936 Winter and Summer Olympics.
In 2008, the Chinese government, in the years leading up to that, made suggestions that China was opening up and would be adopting more internationally accepted norms of governments as articulated by the UN. For example, in 1998, China signed the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and was promising to move to ratification, which would have meant that China's laws and practices would have had to have been adjusted to accommodate independent rule of law and the rights of citizenship. Of course, China hasn't gone that direction. And after the new chairman of the Chinese Communist Party came into power, Xi Jinping, he explicitly repudiated all discussion in the media and in universities of all Western democratic categories like opposition parties, independent rule of law, separation of powers, free elections. You know, all these things are not even allowed to be discussed anymore. And clearly that's not a direction that China is planning to move. So from that point of view, it's a very different context. The idea that, you know, that further engagement with China, as you say, through enhanced trade relations through the WTO and more interaction would lead to China gradually moving towards democratization from an autocratic one-party regime, you know, that China might follow the path of Taiwan and South Korea and, you know, become a nation in the world that would be a contributor to peace and justice and economic prosperity, as opposed to its current status of being hostile towards us, was there. I think in terms of, you know, using COVID as a reason for not allowing world leaders to come to Beijing to support their teams. I mean, part of this, I think, is because Xi Jinping really doesn't want to be engaged by our prime minister or the U.S. president or other national leaders who have very serious concerns about China's regime behavior. You know, we noticed that, for example, this week, Mr. Xi won't be going to Italy for the G20 and won't be going to Glasgow for the COP26. And, you know, I think that that is indicative of his desire to not provide credibility to those multilateral institutions, and also because he doesn't want to be called on the carpet for the, how do you say lies in a nice way, but the violation of commitments and lack of follow through with statements that are characteristic of his rule. So I think from that point of view, we won't have an opportunity to express concern to Mr. Xi. And I would really urge that our diplomats should not be attending the event and shaking hands and smiling with the Chinese Communist leadership in the course of the Olympics, which is what the Chinese government would naturally expect in this kind of celebratory event. But how the Canadian government is going to play it remains to be seen. I think indications are that we largely, at least the current government, identifies the promotion of Canadian prosperity through trade and investment with China as the primary interest of Canada in Canada-China relations, and therefore we're prepared to compromise on a lot of other non-economic aspects to ensure that our large companies that have business arrangements with Chinese Communist business networks are not excluded because Canada is seen as unfriendly to the Chinese Communist Party regime. So, you know, there are just all sorts of reasons why this Olympics is highly problematic for us as Canadians.
Beijing 2022 will be the first major mega event in China since the fall of 2019, when Wuhan hosted the World Military Games. Many questions remain about what happened in Wuhan in the fall of 2019, but China is not cooperating with international investigations of the origin of the coronavirus. Meanwhile, Xi Jinping is further consolidating his power, cracking down on CEOs and celebrities alike, people who have a media profile inside and outside China.
Normally, when a country hosts an Olympics, and most countries that have hosted Olympics have been open countries, but when a country normally hosts an Olympics, they try to showcase all of their people, the best and the brightest, to their celebrities, their CEOs, their athletes, of course. But Xi Jinping is further consolidating his own control and his own profile.
I think that that's a very abject observation. You know, Mr. Xi is determined to neutralize any alternative power and charisma to himself. So, you know, when Jack Ma started to criticize the government's fiscal policy, you know, political power in China basically squashed him like a bug. And other figures who, you know, have support of the people, like celebrities, actors, singers, and so on, are also being forced to step into the shadows again and not continue to mobilize their fans. You know, their social media has been closed down and so on. I think that, and it's not just economic and cultural aspects. Mr. Xi is also consolidating the power of the party state into his own office by neutralizing the power of cabinet ministers, and particularly Li Keqiang, the premier of the state council. You know, when it was Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai was a very important figure. Li Keqiang is someone who really has lost most of his policy-making authority and implementation authority to units which are reporting to the president directly. So, you know, this is not a good thing. you get the power consolidated into one leader surrounded by affirming sycophants, and he gets more and more out of contact with what's really happening on the ground, and then things can start to unravel badly. So, you know, the decline of collective leadership in the Chinese Communist Party is not something that we can welcome because of its potentially destabilizing impact if things start to go wrong. There's only one person that can be blamed for anything that goes wrong at present, and that's Mr. Xi, because all bucks stop with him. And I think that in general, the suppression of freedom of information simply freedoms of choosing your own values and way of being has a terrible effect on the vibrancy and progressive nature of society. Xi's ideology is more and more out of sync with the modern values of a technological society that most Chinese people are now adopting. So, you know, it doesn't bode well for the future. And certainly I don't think that we want to be involved in an Olympics which does anything to affirm what's going on politically in China, because for one thing, it violates our own values. And for another thing, I think that we want to support progressive forces of change in that country, not the forces of repression represented by the current leadership that, as I say, you know, is engaged in genocide, engaged in gross violations of the norms of diplomacy and trade, and seems to be more and more bald in its refusal to pretend that it's anything other than a power grab. You know, the recent economic coercion of Australia over the Australian government's stance that there should be a free and independent international inquiry into the sources of the COVID-19 resulted in China engaging in imposition of non-tariff barriers on significant Australian exports to China. And, you know, Australia has its total exports, about a third of them go to that country. And they didn't even bother to justify it. You know, when they, with the Canadian canola seeds, China falsely claimed that they weren't taking them because we had too much impurities in the dockage. It's not actually true, but it was their line. Or with regard to their sanctions against meat designed to do further economic coercion with regard to trying to get the prime minister somehow or other to pick up the phone and tell an associate justice of the BC Superior Court to rule a certain way on the Mrs. Meng case. You know, at least they tried to have some fig leaf of justification. Now they're not using the fig leaf. They're simply saying we're powerful and we're exceptional, and we don't have to abide by the norms that other states have to abide by in state-to-state economic and diplomatic interaction. Well, this is very dangerous. You know, it really is a repudiation of what keeps the world stable, peaceful, and prosperous.
Thanks again to my guest, Charles Burton, senior fellow with the MacDonald Laurier Institute and a former Canadian diplomat and intelligence advisor. News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In Mainichi News, Braille voters puzzled by Japan election candidates with same phonetic name. Two women sharing the same phonetic reading of their names are running for the Shimane No. 1 constituency in the October 31st House of Representatives election. The two candidates, both named Akiko Kamai, spell their names differently in kanji characters, but the groups of visually impaired people say there's no way to distinguish between them in Braille voting, as Braille is based on phonograms. In Taiwan news, China using closed civilian airport to launch Taiwan incursions. Shantou Waisha Airport, west across the strait from Taiwan's city of Tainan, has seen detachments of People's Liberation Army aircraft since at least October last year, according to satellite imagery provided by Planet Labs. The airport used to service the city of Shantou, but halted operations in 2011 when nearby Jiyang Chaoshan Airport opened. In the Straits Times, ex-Malaysian PM Najib poised for comeback despite one MDB conviction. Two-time Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad on Wednesday raised the specter of Najib returning to contest the next general election, saying it has taken a long time for the numerous criminal cases against him to make their way through the court process. The next polls are due latest by September 2023, but could take place as soon as next year. Najib, who served as Prime Minister for 9 years until 2018, was sentenced to 12 years jail last year for corruption linked to the misappropriation of funds from the now defunct 1MDB state fund. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Oregonian, erratic driver shoots at a motorist, eludes police, crashes stolen truck into garage, steals Ricky Bobby racing suit, authorities say. A 25-year-old man stands accused of driving a stolen truck erratically, firing at a fellow motorist who then fired back with a rifle, leading police on a chase, crashing into a garage, running into the woods, and breaking into a Beaver Lake home only to emerge wearing a racing car costume of Will Ferrell's character from Talladega Nights, The Ballad of Ricky Bobby. Authorities arrested Alex Ibarra Gomez. The case drew Sheriff's Office patrol units, Oregon City Police, state troopers, the Washington County Air Unit, and members of the Clackamas County SWAT and crisis negotiation teams. On King 5 News, pay-per-view autopsy event canceled in Seattle after criticism. Organizers had planned a cadaver dissection class in Seattle where an autopsy would have been performed on a dead body before a live audience. Tickets were sold for $500 to the public to the event on Halloween in a Marriott Hotel conference room in Seattle. The Cadaver Lab is touring as part of the Oddities and Curiosities Expo, which travels across the country. The cadavers come from MedEd Labs, a Las Vegas-based for-profit company that accepts donations of human bodies for, quote, medical and surgical research, education, and training, end quote. On Czech News, containers from MV Zim Kingston found on shore near Cape Scott. The head of the New Charles... 321... On Czech News, containers from MV Zim Kingston found on shore near Cape Scott. The head of the New Chalneth Tribal Council, which represents First Nations with lands covering 30% of Vancouver Island's west coast, says the lack of communication has been troubling. 109 containers fell off the MV Zim Kingston when it encountered rough seas near Bamfield more than a week ago, far more than the 40 or so containers initially believed to be lost. In 2016, when the Korean cargo ship Hanjin Seattle lost 35 shipping containers, coastal communities were left to deal with the fallout. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. When your face is gone, you won't stand alone. We'll all stand together, cause this is our home. And it don't matter what color you are, cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to children across BC who are learning about charity. Halloween is also National UNICEF Day in Canada. The little orange boxes filled with coins, a reminder that there are people in need all year round. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to Bob at thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
Vaccine, 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 vaccine. Because once you're dead, then that's a bit too late. I know I'm trying to be funny now, but I'm dead serious about the vaccine. I think we all want to get back to normal, whatever that is, and that would be a great shot in the arm, wouldn't it?
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of October 31st, 2021. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on October 31st in 1918, American daredevil Harry Gardner brought his Human Fly Act to British Columbia to promote Victory Bonds, the federal government scheme to finance Canada's First World War effort? On Halloween, he climbed the outside of the Hotel Vancouver and the city's tallest tower at the time, the World Building, which would later become the Sun Tower. The mass gatherings were later blamed for spreading the Spanish flu. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to Bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews.
Until next week.